Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's give you another couple seconds to grab a cup of coffee, but we do want to begin in a timely way. Let me extend a warm welcome to everyone here to join us at CSIS for this what's going to be a very interesting and I think productive discussion coming out from the CSIS work on a global space agenda. I'm Bates Gill. I work here at CSIS handling a lot of the work regarding China, holding the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. And it's been my very fortunate opportunity to work with Vincent Sabatier here at CSIS and try to build what has been, I think, a very successful effort, primarily and principally a result of the work of Vincent's program, to establish non-governmental and unofficial, but I think very fruitful, ties with the Chinese space program. And this discussion today, I think, builds upon that very successful effort. And we're very, very pleased to be able to welcome today two of the leading members of Congress who are working extremely hard to examine and help establish a more strategic, a more outward-looking, a more pragmatic and realistic policy of engagement with China, including on issues related to space. Let me make a brief introduction of both of them. First, Representative Mark Kirk is from the 10th Congressional District in Illinois, which is located near Chicago. He is now serving in his third term in Congress and comes to this work with a very interesting background, having been a naval reservist and has also worked in the U.S. House International Relations Committee as a staffer and also with the World Bank. And as I recall, gained some of his advanced education from abroad as well. So something of a rare an interesting member of Congress who's had as much experience as he has abroad, including, I would add, serving as an air crewman over Iraq during Operation Northern Watch. Representative Rick Larson comes to us from the 2nd Congressional District of Washington State, which is located near Seattle, and he, too, is currently in his third term. Rick serves also on the House Armed Services Committee, the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and the Agriculture Committee. Now, why have we invited these two gentlemen here? I think from my point of view, most importantly, Mark and Rick are co-founders and co-chairmen of the U.S.-China Working Group, which is a bipartisan organization founded in June 2005, made up of members of Congress. 2005 was an interesting year up on Capitol Hill as a number of such groups made up of members of Congress were formed in order to take a more careful and hands-on look at the emergent U.S.-China relationship. The U.S.-China Working Group, I think, is the most active and most interesting, and I think has taken a position of engagement and pragmatic approach towards China. Both Rick and Mark traveled to China most recently in January of this year, where, among other things, they were able to make a visit to Jiuquan in Gansu province, which is one of China's space launch centers. Jiuquan is famous in China for having been the site where China launched its first satellite into space, the Dongfang Hong 1, back in 1970. And more recently, and perhaps more famously, Jiuquan was the site of China's first manned space mission, the Shenzhou 5, launched back in October of 2003. It's very remarkable and rare, and I think it might have even been the very first time that members of Congress from the United States were able to visit this sensitive site in China. And it was there, that I think, that they were able to discuss with Chinese counterparts the possibilities for future space-related collaboration between the United States and China. So both for their interest in China broadly, and because of their interests they've demonstrated specifically in issues related to space. We are extremely fortunate to have them here. Let me just quote a couple of things that these two gentlemen have said recently. Congressman Kirk said, "The 21st century will not be a happy one if China and the United States are against each other. There is a significant opportunity for both countries to enjoy unparalleled prosperity if we cooperate." Congressman Larson said, "Our best interest is in engagement with China where we can work toward common goals and solve shared problems." I couldn't agree more, and I think we're very fortunate to have two gentlemen like this on Capitol Hill who recognize the strategic interest we have in a pragmatic and realistic approach to China. So please join me in welcoming Mark Kirk and Rick Larson. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone for coming to talk about Rick and I's favorite topic, which is U.S. relationship with China. In my work as a congressman representing the suburbs above Chicago, I note how in Washington, the foreign policy discussion is dominated by two countries, Iran and Iraq, and now sometimes North Korea. But when I'm back home, China comes up more often than any other country. And we have formed this group to look uniquely for the Congress at the long haul of establishing China as the country with which the United States has a primary diplomatic relationship. The U.S.-China Working Group, now encompassing about 50 Republicans and Democrats, it doesn't take a position on issues, but we try not to be dragon slayers in this and not to be panda huggers, but to develop a more nuanced view towards China. We were two of six members of Congress to participate in the recent Hu Jintao summit, and we are now working on the upcoming Bush-Hu Jintao bilat at the UNGA in September. And looking forward to the NASA administrator's visit to China also in September. For the China Working Group, we've been looking at a number of practical steps the U.S. and China can take to improve our relations. For example, we have advocated the establishment of a defense telephone link between the Pentagon and the Ministry of National Defense, looking at beefing up China's formal legal commitment on intellectual property enforcement with enforcement measures, and looking now at a joint dialogue that Rick and I would like to start on protecting the Olympic Games. We've also talked about space cooperation, especially in the area of search and rescue. With regard to space cooperation, the United States and China signed an agreement with regard to search and rescue on the surface of the Earth if a U.S. or Chinese crew deorbited in the wrong place. We think we should probably take a step further and look at a search and rescue capability for taikonauts or astronauts in orbit by formal engineering and completion of a common docking ring between the Shenzhou vehicle and U.S.-compatible vehicles, so that if ever one country has a bird on the pad and is able to accomplish a rescue in orbit, it would make taikonauts or astronauts simply safer because of that agreement. The reason why we're working on this topic and why we asked to see Juchuan was that I think the manned space program has a potential all out of proportion to its size and cost for improving the diplomatic, political, and military atmosphere between the United States and China. One can only think about your childhood or mine and the command that the U.S. manned space program had in influencing the direction that we all took in our careers and our aspirations for our country. And I simply brought this as one example. Many of you have seen it, the Chinese first day covers and command that it has, the space program, the Shenzhou 5 and Shenzhou 6 missions had on Chinese popular culture. And if we can have an element of cooperation, and I'm being very specific here, with the civilian manned space program of China and the United States, I think it would have an enormous bilateral political development. Let me just conclude before handing over to Rick to talk about our big visit to the launch facility with a report that we had commissioned by NASA. I'm a NASA appropriator. I sit on the subcommittee that funds NASA. And we asked NASA to do a formal report on China's activities in space. This was the report that was transmitted to us in May of this year. And I think it reflects a growing attention that we should pay to China's space program, both military and civilian, and how the how the United States interacts with that. With that, let me hand it over to Rick and just say that everything we do on the U.S.-China Working Group is relentlessly bipartisan, and I'll have him talk about our groundbreaking first-ever visit to the Chinese Space Launch Complex.
Well, it was cold. January in the Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region is a cold time of year, but I'll cover with you all some of those some of the things that we saw, as well as some of our visit with the vice administrator of the Chinese National Space Agency. I think it's appropriate that we're meeting today in the context of the U.S. launch, the shuttle Discovery, and the work that they're doing in space right now, as just as well as the fact that you know, China continues headlong in its development of space. One, I was doing some notes for this meeting today, and one author noted that space is three things. It's a zone of commerce, it's a scientific laboratory, and it's a military operation platform. Those characteristics apply to basically every country that is seeking to create their own space in space. And as a result, there's opportunities for cooperation, for competition, as well as there's potential for conflict. And so I think it's important that we have this discussion, especially in light of China now being only one of three countries that have put people into space. Our conversation in Beijing at the China National Space Agency really left me with a deep impression, and I'll let you know what that impression is after I just cover with you what the vice administrator said. He was talking about international cooperation that China is currently involved in, and this you all know this, I'm sure. First off, China is cooperating with Brazil on CBERS. It's a co-development of a satellite. China provides a launch vehicle. It's built in Brazil, and it's used to monitor and development resources of the environment in South America. China is cooperating with the European Space Agency and Galileo specifically and a few other things. China and Russia do some cooperation. China is cooperating with countries of the Asia-Pacific region on small multi-mission satellites. And as he was going down this list, of elements or areas where they're cooperating with all these other countries, it became clear that they're not cooperating with the United States. We're not cooperating with them. And there are obvious reasons for that that we've been through in the most recent past. But the other message, and I think the big message for me, was China's not waiting for the United States to cooperate with them when it comes to space. And you couple that with the fact that put people into space, I think it ought to force a discussion in the U.S. among policymakers about what our approach to China and space will be, since they are cooperating with others, they're not waiting for us to cooperate, and they put people into space. I think those are three big factors that we need to consider as we move forward in looking at China and space in the U.S. It's also very interesting. We were asked to deliver a message back to our colleagues in the House and the Senate that China wants to cooperate with the United States, and we said we'd be happy to deliver that, and that's as much as we can do, which we have to let folks know. But there are some challenges in Congress. The environment in Congress with regards to China generally and space specifically provides a lot of challenge. First off, there's a large amount of distrust surrounding China's space program in Congress because of questions of intent. Congress views the ambiguity of the PLA's role over the space program and concerns over dual-use technology as major barriers to U.S.-China space cooperation. There are concerns in Congress and the Pentagon about the potential for anti-satellite technology. There's just general an anti-China sentiment created by other issues that affect the U.S.-China relationship, and that those create opposition to cooperation on any number of fronts. We're obviously very interested in China's space program, noting the report that Mark and the folks in the Appropriations Committee were able to get out of NASA. But I think it's important to say that we need to deepen Congress's understanding of China, the complexities and difficulties of the U.S. relationship with China, and then specifically on space as well, to find ways to increase transparency and address the real benefits of cooperation at any level with China. And I think that's where the U.S.-China Working Group comes into play. We need to make clear that there are real concerns in Congress about on the national security front. Again, not just with regards to space, but with regards to China's military budget, with regards to transparency and the lack of military-to-military cooperation, which is why Mark and I have pushed a defense telephone link between the Pentagon and the Ministry of National Defense in China, as well as a variety of other things. I think if there's one theme about the U.S.-China Working Group that would apply yet to this issue, is that there are a lot of folks who are looking for grabbing the $1,000 bill instead of trying to pick up nickels and dimes in the relationship with China. And I think because if China sees our relationship as really long-term, then we may want to as well see it as really long-term and focus on picking up nickels and dimes along the way in order to build up to a place where we can, you know, grab that $1,000 bill, grab the big prize, whatever that big prize is in terms of our relationship with China and theirs with us. And so we're trying to find ways to find things to point out that could be easy nickels and dimes to pick up. One thing coming up with Administrator Griffin's trip to China this fall, September, is to try to develop an agenda that would be useful to him and useful to and respectful, I think, of China's space program, which could include a further discussion about a common docking advice. It could include discussion about scientific exploration. It could include debris tracking. And it could include what would be a largely symbolic event, but I think a recognition that China is has made it into space, and that is perhaps something as simple to do once it's done. Very hard to get set up, as we found when we were in China. But that is to just try to meet with the two taikonauts who went up in October 2005. Meet with them, get a picture with them. I think that would be highly symbolic. But also, I think the Chinese would be very proud to show that off. I was both Mark and I were given a commemorative stamp collection and postcard collection of the Shenzhou 6 flight, autographed by the taikonauts, and I showed it to a Chinese friend of mine who said that if I were to go back to China right now and sell that, I could get a lot of money for it because these guys are national heroes, well known throughout China. So again, I only bring that up because there are some symbolic things that we can do to show some recognition. Where that leads us, I don't know, but I think the three main points I made about they're cooperating with others, they're not waiting for us, they put people in space, indicates that we do need to take another look at what our space relationship is with China. We may just come to the same place, but I think it's a discussion worth having.
Great.
Thank you very much for those comments. I think we have about 40 minutes for Q&As, so we will welcome your question.
Well, thank you very much for coming by.
Brendan?
In terms of...
Oh, could you identify yourself?
Brendan Curry with the Space Foundation, I apologize. You mentioned some of the roadblocks to potential cooperation, dual use, kind of military things. Could you help maybe tell us what non-military issues are causing heartburn in the Congress, currency valuation, things like that might help give us a because this is a predominantly aerospace and defense crowd, but there might be some other issues that help fill in the lines for us on what else there other hurdles there are.
Sure. I think intellectual property rights enforcement, although China has a I think most people would conclude now, China has a good IPR regime in place to their laws. They still lack appropriate and aggressive enforcement. It is spotty. There's a Chinese proverb, and I only know three, but this one's very applicable, and that is the hills are high and the emperor is far away. And when it comes to IPR enforcement, that's one of the biggest problems. What Beijing says isn't exactly what happens, say, in the Gansu province, for instance, on IPR or even down south. IPR enforcement's huge. Currency is an issue for some business interests. It is not a big issue for others. IPR tends to be the number one thing. Human rights and democracy always come up in conversation with members of Congress. And it's not, you know, these issues aren't Democrat or Republican either. They really, you know, span the globe, if you will, within Congress. It's just that, folks who maybe pick human rights as their issue or currency valuation, my colleagues in Congress, haven't realized yet that if they were to get together, they could actually, maybe push our policy down some paths that wouldn't be very positive. But they don't get together because they're so focused on, you know, this one set of issues. And I think that creates a space for folks like Mark and me and the folks in the U.S.-China Working Group to try to educate members, try to understand the complexities of the relationships that exist between the U.S. and China.
I just say that we talk about how everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. With regard to China, of the three tribes that run Washington, the White House, the Senate, and the House, I've characterized the White House view towards China as nuanced and complex. The Senate view towards China is at least multifaceted, with some ups and some downs. And the House view towards China is relentlessly negative and highly misinformed. We started our group in the wake of the CNOOC bid for UNICAL. And my impression was that if I had gone onto the House floor and said, it's just awful that CNOOC has made this bid because China allows no U.S. oil investment in their country, everyone would have agreed with me, and that is completely wrong. If I had said that it's terrible that China is bidding for UNICAL because UNICAL has a huge retail presence in the United States and still runs hundreds of gas stations, people would have said yes. And yet UNICAL had sold those stations long ago. If I had said UNICAL stands for the Union Oil Company of California and a vast percentage of their operations happens in California, people would have said yes, and yet UNICAL is largely an Indonesian operation. It's important for us to be accurate with regard to China. It's perfectly acceptable to criticize China when you have a correct means. What we are against is uninformed criticism, which is largely what I regard as dominant on the House floor today.
John Logsdon from George Washington University. Mr. Kirk, in your remarks, you kind of verbally underline working with the civilian human spaceflight program. Mr. Larson, you said the role of the PLA is a bit unclear. Can you share the insights into that relationship you brought away?
Let me just talk about our trip, because we asked to see the launch facility, and I knew the sensitivity of the site, and so I was very specific that I wanted to see the assembly building and launch facility for manned civilian space, being very, very specific. And to my surprise, they permitted this. But it was clear when we traveled all the way to Gansu province, when we took one of the coldest buses I've ever been on, all the way into the launch site, that this was still largely a military-administered site. And it was the Ministry of National Defense who largely controlled this site. Let me just say, when we were there with Congressman Tom Feeney, who represents Kennedy Space Center, his wife who actually works in the Vehicle Assembly Building in Florida, we were struck by how new the facility was, how well maintained. And even when we walked into the Vehicle Assembly Building, I think I heard a visible gasp from Tom when he saw how large and how modern and in some ways how more capable the Chinese VAB was than the one at Kennedy Space Center. All of this led to a discussion on the way back, probably the most frank discussion we had during the mission with our hosts on the long ride back, about if a cooperation agenda could be built, how could it be built? And I think one of the things that would be necessary is a vast upgrade in the transparency of the Chinese civilian space program. Its budget, its operation, its command, and its direction. Over the long haul, if China had an entirely civilian space agency that was completely run and administered and even guarded by a civilian agency, that would improve potential for cooperation and international context. We're not there yet, but if I could underscore one point that would increase the comfort zone with the Chinese, it would be to create that civilianization of their program as our program did in the 1950s. So,
yeah, I think it's going to always tend to be crossovers, certainly crossover in our civilian program. We've got military folks as well as civilian folks in the space shuttle program. We started with putting Air Force and Navy folks into our rockets. So there's always going to be crossover. The issue in China, or the issue with us, is that we pretty much know who runs it, who sets policy. We're just not sure who runs it and who sets policy. There is the Commission for Science, Technology, and Industry for National Defense, COSTIN. There's the National Space Administration. There's also the Armaments Department of the PLA who are involved. We're trying to, there are smarter people in this room probably on this issue, but we're trying to divine, and sometimes it's like trying to divine some things, trying to divine who runs the show and who we need to talk to, because that will define what agenda, frankly, is practical and acceptable to U.S. policymakers. We are not going to run headlong into this, into a relationship. We're going to walk very slowly, one more proverb. We're going to touch the stones when we cross the river. We are not going to just jump in the river and swim across. We're going to do this very carefully, if we do it at all. But we have to. I think it's time we have a discussion to decide if we do it at all. But transparency is pretty important here. We'd like to see it be important to China.
David Vaccaro, Futron Corporation. You mentioned that China was interested in cooperating in the United States and voiced support for that idea. Did the Chinese put forth any specific proposals about how they might want to cooperate with us?
That's a great question that struck me last night. I was going through my notes on my visit, and what struck me the most is that the Chinese say they want to cooperate. And I was reading some of the, there's a this China Security, Bringing Chinese Perspectives to Washington. It's filled a lot of great papers written by Chinese scholars, but it's definitely from a point of view of the Chinese who are involved in their program. And what struck me most is that there's a lot of talk about how it would be in the U.S. interest to cooperate with China, that's kind of where it ends. It's sort of like when we talk to the Ministry of National Defense and they say, well, the U.S. has should have no concerns about Chinese military policy or Chinese military budgets. The answer is, I can't take that to the bank to anybody. You have to let's explore what that means and let's define that. Let's try to understand what the Chinese on these issues, in particular, what they mean, how they see things in our interests. I'm sure we have ideas about what's in our interests as well, but saying it's in our interest to have our potential competitor or potential partner say it's in our interest doesn't mean it's in our interest. And we need to do a better job of defining our own interests, and I would like to hear what the Chinese think is in our interests as well.
I just say I got the sense that we were the ones coming up with the specifics, and in the spirit of the U.S.-China working group of tangible steps that could actually be taken by defining the orbital search and rescue, by defining the common docking ring, by proposing that the NASA administrator go to China, by saying that we should meet the taikonauts. We've actually gone forward and say that the Shenzhou 6 should come on exhibit to a U.S. museum. My favorite is the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. Rick has a favorite museum in Seattle. All those as part of the dialogue, high-level visits by China to the United States this summer, and the Bush-Hu Jintao bilat in New York in September are part of what we would hope would be a growing, practical, working agenda. My take on the House of Representatives floor right now is if I said that China had a very active manned space program, that would still be news to a lot of my colleagues who missed it entirely. We participated in a lot of the media, largely Asian media, around the launch and recovery of the Shenzhou 6. And I was struck by how in my media market in Chicago, it was almost a non-event. And yet, my God, this was the third nation on the planet orbiting people in their own built vehicle. You know, in the history of the 21st century, a fairly big leap forward. So I think this entire field is one in which the Congress is largely unaware. And when you think about China plans for its own space station, or China plans for a lunar rover, that is all news to most of our colleagues.
I just say, as a member of the House Armed Services Committee and the Strategic Subcommittee, we're moving forward and just looking generally at the issue of space policy from a military perspective. And say a lot of my colleagues on the committee were surprised that, one, we were able to visit the launch facility, and surprised, secondly, that China is advanced as they are. There's folks who've mentioned this term space race. I mean, I don't know that we're in a space race with China. If this thing was a marathon, we've got 385 yards left, and they're still at the starting line, really, in my view, when it comes to how far we've advanced and where we have the potential to go. So I think, you know, we've got they have a long way to go to get to where we are in our space program, which gives us an opportunity, I think, to again explore where we might be able to cooperate, and if there are places that we can cooperate. But I think there's a general amount of surprise about how far they had advanced.
Colin Clark, Washington Aerospace Briefing. There's been a great deal of talk from Mr. Calvert and some of your other colleagues about the large number of engineers that China supposedly graduates each year. There seems to be a lot of discussion about how many of these are actually engineers as we would define them. I've spoken with some of the House staff about whether we should cooperate and why. And several of them have said it's too early. we don't really, you know, with the Russians, we started cooperating because we wanted their engineers to be doing something other than working for people we didn't like. What are the interests that the ruthless, nasty, brutish, short interests that bring us together?
I would just say first, to learn more about a very active program, which is rapidly developing. Number two, in my view, there are two space programs we ought to watch very carefully. One is that of the government of China. The other is of the government of India. There is a large degree of ignorance about both of those programs at senior levels of the U.S. Congress, and I think that's to their detriment. As far as short-term benefits, I think it's important to outline what we are saying and what we are not saying. You know, a broad-based agenda of cooperation and joint exploration in orbit in other countries is not what we are talking about. What we are talking about is ground and orbital search and rescue, and possibly some exchange. To become better informed on this. I will say one other thing. There is a political idea out there of a flood of Chinese engineers arriving in the United States who are largely mining U.S. databases and accelerating Chinese development. Part of that is true, but that is actually less true today than it was 5 years ago. The dominant trend that I hear from leading technical universities in Illinois is that most Chinese students are going home. The rate of Chinese people who want to stay and in any way participate is dropping very quickly because the job prospects in China are so hot and the pay is so good that a quick tour through the United States is all they're interested in. And other foreign destinations are becoming more interesting. It is so difficult to get a visa in the United States to process your technical university education that European and other destinations are becoming the preferred destinations for Chinese engineering. And so we're seeing a drop in the number of Chinese students coming to the United States and a rapid departure of those who have stayed from previous rates going elsewhere. Rick and I have been concerned about the other side of the equation, by a rough estimate, there are approximately 150 million people in China that have or are studying English. There are only 28,000 Americans that have studied Chinese, an enormous intellectual gap that causes our leading exporters, the commercial and economic side of our government, and the military and intelligence side of our government to have a huge human capital shortfall in the ability to understand and monitor what's happening in China. So we proposed a U.S.-China Engagement Act that would dramatically upgrade resources for the instruction of Chinese to Americans, both at university and high school levels, to redress that balance. Because what I see is a growing gap, but it's not the one you think of. Increasing number of Chinese returning home and studying in non-American universities from what was happening 10 years ago.
With regards to space, I think right now what we need to consider is our strategic interests, and I don't mean militarily strategic. I mean that China sees the space program as part of its bigger economic development goal. When we were there in January, President Hu had a big conference of scientists and physicists at the university from the universities, outlining his science and technology program. They want to be the 10th most technologically advanced country by 2015. China does. They're going to do that by indigenously or by importing, and largely they're going to do it indigenously. The space program is part of that economic development goal, and it gets back to what I said earlier. They're not waiting. They're not waiting for us. It's like water going down a hill. If it hits a rock, it goes around. you know, if they can't get into the, if Chinese students can't get into the U.S. to study, they'll go to a different country to study. They are going to do it, and we need to, I think U.S. policy needs to understand that, address it, and find ways to engage China on any number of issues, because that country is thinking more strategically in terms of global competitiveness than I think we are.
Ian Pryke, George Mason University. From time to time, statements appear in the press that are attributed to senior Chinese government officials that relate to the pace and the ambitions of their human spaceflight program. Given what you gentlemen know, how much credence do you apply to these statements?
Well, if they said they're going to be on the moon by next year, I wouldn't give a lot of credence to it. In fact, there's some conflict. You get a conflicting story about whether their ultimate goal is to put a person on the moon or not, or a timeline to put a person on the moon. I think recently they're hedging that. But I think generally the timelines of, you know, hitting timelines about lunar orbit and space stations and possibly a Chinese taikonaut on the moon by, you know, 2025. I think generally, I mean, that's a pretty consistent message. Again, but for some of the hedging about when they put a person on the moon, but I think the rest of it, you know, it's been pretty consistent. Based on what I saw as well, I'm not an expert. I'm a member of Congress, so there's a gap between those two. All right, but based on what I saw. And I ask you to read an article, a lot of good articles out there, but space.com, April 12, 2006, did an interview with Tom Feeney from Florida, who went on the trip with us. And I think it's his impressions of how far China has come, I think are pretty interesting to read. And, again, I'd put a lot of credibility to the general timeline that they have in place.
Just say my impression is the military developments in space by China are profound and not well understood by the West. Civilian development, my sense is, has slightly slowed, despite the technical prowess and achievement and PR attention put on the program. The tangible, transparent financial commitments by the central government of China to the space program could be larger than they are, and so I got some sense that the momentum of the program on the civilian side is not as big as it could be.
I would just say this too. I'd agree with that, because I don't think China wants to make a mistake. When they put the next set of folks up in space for that specific mission, they want it to go absolutely right. They don't want to, you know, have to delay a launch. They don't want to have to, you know, rescue their folks in space, rescue them on the ground. My impression is that they will not do it until they know it's, you know, going to be right. So they'll take as much time as they need to get it right.
Yeah, Steve Benson, CSIS, Russia-Eurasia program. The Russians, their perspectives and sensitivities, do they play in, and how will they impact your thinking on this, the engagement with China in space?
I'm not here's one of those areas where you're the expert and I'm not. You're probably more qualified. You're probably more qualified to speak on that. I think we don't generally look – we're not generally looking at China and Russia and space, although there's cooperation. We've been looking at this, for instance, what China and Russia did last year in a military exercise. We're looking at them right now with regards to North Korea, Iran, sort of some of these, I don't want to downplay them, I call them day-to-day issues, but they're sort of the crisis of the week issues as opposed to something strategic. I'm not aware of anything that's out there that looks specifically from a strategic perspective between China and Russia in space. I'm sure it's out there, but it really hasn't cropped up.
I just say one can only take a quick peek at the Shenzhou 6 and see a striking similarity to another space vehicle we all know well. And so I think it's clear who is the parent of the Chinese program. The interesting thing is when we were at the Space Launch Complex, though, the Chinese told us about significant reengineering of the vehicle. And so I don't think we were treated to any sort of view of anything that looked particularly different than an up-engineered Soyuz. So right now the parentage is very close. But given the pace of this program and the general development of Chinese military developments, I think you're going to see a diversion of the two programs. I would expect in the future, but right now they seem very closely related.
I would like to add something on this point. When we visited China, I was fortunate. It was the time where President Putin was in Beijing, actually. And so there was a lot of emphasis on the cooperation with Russia across the board, because it's a Russia year in China. And so, we asked the question, what about space? And I understand they have currently more than 50 ongoing cooperation projects in space with Russia.
And one other thing, you know, how Napoleon talks about how amateurs talk about tactics and professionals talk about logistics. And there might be an analogy in space, how amateurs talk about manned space vehicles and professionals talk about boosters. And Chinese development in booster technology is enormous.
Christine Zee from Phoenix TV of Hong Kong. As regard to the personnel exchange, like engineers, do we have any specific proposal right now to get Chinese, you know, space staff or engineers to come to the U.S. exchange?
My read on it is a lot is hanging on the administrator's visit in September. That is a very important visit for the United States. And how that visit goes, I think, is critical. Yeah, not that I am aware of, and I know the administrator will be prepared to have that sort of discussion. And from Rick and I's perspective of increased knowledge and engagement with China, we really hope that visit goes well. We're a font of proposals, but
I got a million of them.
Yeah, right. I would just say before Rick and I have openly talked about proposals, we generally have a private dialogue with the Chinese, which is why we're confidently talking about the defense telephone link. We're confidently talking about orbital search and rescue. We're confidently talking about the visit of the administrator. I think I know where things should go in the future, but one of the things that we like to build is a level of trust with the government of China, and to discuss some new ideas privately first to see where there's potential, and then if there seems to be potential, then go ahead and talk to DOD, talk to state, talk to NASA about how this can go forward before we'd go public.
Maybe we can talk afterwards.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Graham Gibbs with the Canadian Space Agency. In years past, the Chinese had indicated an interest in participating at some level in the International Space Station program. Of course, that did not happen. When you were there, have they ever mentioned, have they reopened that discussion at all in terms of a visit, a docking, or any form of interest in participation?
My recollection or conversation is that they would they're still in the process of trying to reopen that conversation. They're still interested. Yeah.
Anybody else?
Yes. I'm Jocelyn
I'm not sure. I don't know how to answer that question. I have to think about it. But clearly, space is important to the U.S. commerce currently. When you put your credit card into a gas pump to pay for your gas. Actually, these days, one tank will pay for a satellite. So that's when you, you know, this little thing here, this my BlackBerry helps me out every day with my schedule and emails, and but that's obviously hooked up with satellite. So just on its face, I think the American people, and we're exploring this in the committee, the American people ought to have a deeper understanding, if they don't now, but I think it's helpful to have a deeper understanding of how space and satellites currently help our economy move forward. The point I was making at the beginning is that that applies the same to every country. And so, you know, when we consider that China may want, you know, is putting up satellites and wants to put up satellites in space, you know, sometimes we tend to see it strictly through a military lens. That's certainly, I think, appropriate to do, but it's not appropriate to look at it only through that lens. China's like any other country. They want to grow economically. They've got a killer cell phone system. The cell phone coverage between Jiuquan and the Space Launch Facility, a three-hour drive through the Gobi Desert, is better coverage than on Whidbey Island, South Whidbey Island in my district. I was calling halfway around the world to my chief of staff saying, hey, I'm in the Gobi Desert. And he, you know, and he's like, "What? Why are you calling? It's 11 a.m. or 11 p.m. Why are you calling? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" You know, China sees satellites in part as good for its commerce, just like we do, just like countries of Europe do, just like Canada does. But obviously, there are other applications to satellite in space that cause us concern.
And I would just say probably the biggest payoff on a civilian space cooperation is political. Nothing dominates the two cultures of the countries more than the pride in taikonauts and astronauts, what's happening in space. And if there is cooperation, it then narrows the space for those who would want to have a negative relationship, and broadens the space for those who want a positive relationship. There is enormous potential if China and the United States decide to not have a military competition and continue down the Deng Xiaoping policy of China as a huge open potential commercial space of great potential for a number of U.S. employers and economic interests. And we all know the other side of that coin. Everybody here old enough to be good, solid Cold Warrior veterans. I think if we can prevent a Cold War from breaking out and over the long haul move the relationship to more of the kind of a commercial competition that the United States has with the European Union, without a huge amount of discussion of military competition, the net prosperity benefit for the two countries is enormously enhanced. I don't know how this is going to turn out. You know, one of the reasons for the U.S.-China Working Group is to influence the peaceful side of the outcome much more than the military side. As a military man, as a guy who's still serving in uniform one weekend a month, I am fully aware of the military side of this equation, which is why I would like the peaceful side to work out if it can. And the symbolic nature of civilian space cooperation is so powerful that I think that's the biggest benefit for the United States.
Last question, maybe.
Alan Ladwig, Northrop Grumman. Did you get a sense, is most of what China has built done by the government, or is there any... Did you get any sense of a industry base at all?
Yeah, it's largely government driven. I didn't get any sense of any private industry. It might be small, but if it exists at all, but it's largely driven by the government policy as well as operation, construction, a whole bit.
Yeah, my sense of this, not to anthropomorphize too much, but the structure of the Chinese civilian space program is somewhat similar to where we were structurally back like 56, 57, hugely coming out of the Air Force, you know, with some civilian applications. We're not there with a whole range of civilian launch vehicles, civilian management, civilian program, and a civilian contractor base. I don't think we saw any of that. Great.
I will have two little questions before we close. The first one is, as you discussed the Cold War, of course everybody is thinking about the Apollo-Soyuz model of cooperation where a special ring was developed. I understand that during this development, the State Department took the lead and the space agencies were working under a diplomatic umbrella. Is this the model you are looking for in your proposal?
I used to work in the State Department, and my strong preference is to have as few State Department diplomats in the engineering as possible, knowing how mathematics and engineering adverse my former colleagues were.
And maybe the last question, I hope somebody had asked a question, is about the recent events. The Department of Treasury recently published a statement in which some a major Chinese company involved in space were sanctioned for proliferation of missile technology towards Iran. That's the first point. The second point is, of course, the launch by North Korea of ballistic missiles, which everybody agrees contains some Chinese design, even if the proliferation took place a while back. How do you think those two events will affect a possible discussions and possibly the trip of Dr. Griffin in China?
I think there's a reality to the relationship that we have with China, and that reality is there are many relationships that we have with China on a variety of levels. And with the two issues you bring up, those are issues that we're going to have to address, that we will have to confront even China with. You know, I think back to the president's speech in the South Lawn, and there were obviously some problems that happened at that South Lawn speech. But the point I want to make about it is that he talked about democracy and human rights, for instance, and people said, well, that was he shouldn't have done that. That was sort of too much in the face of President Hu. The fact is, when you talk to the United States, you have to talk democracy and human rights. It's just part of who we are. We're going to talk jobs. We're going to talk the economy. We're going to talk military issues. And the point I'm making is, if these are issues that make us uncomfortable, and they do, then we're going to talk about them, and the Chinese should expect that we're going to talk about them. They may be uncomfortable to talk about, but we're going to have to address these issues if we're going to even get to a point where we can talk about moving forward. With regards specifically to North Korea, tomorrow the U.S.-China Working Group is hosting four members of Congress, a meeting with Ambassador Zhou, China, to discuss North Korea, to discuss the Chinese delegation's visit to North Korea this week, and to communicate our members' views on how we would like to see this work turn out as well. So we'll get a chance to talk directly with China tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, Congressman, thank you very much for coming, and at CSIS, thank you very much for your informed criticism and trying to define a positive agenda with China. Thank you very much for everybody here for coming today to our global space agenda. We'll have future events in the fall, and we'll let you know. Please.